As a child, Susie had a passionate temper, and it cost her much remorse and many tears before she learned to govern it. But after that, it was a wholesome salt, and her character was the stronger and healthier for its presence. It enabled her to be good with dignity. It preserved her not only from being good for vanity's sake, but from even the appearance of it. In looking back over the long vanished years, it seems but natural and excusable that I should dwell with longing affection and preference upon incidents of her young life which made it beautiful to us, and that I should let its few and small offenses go unsummoned and unreproached. In the summer of 1880, when Susie was just 8 years of age, the family were at Quarry Farm, on top of a high hill 3 miles from Elmira, New York, where we always spent our summers in those days. Hay-cutting time was approaching, and Susie and Clara were counting the hours, for the time was big with a great event for them. They had been promised that they might mount the wagon and ride home from the fields on the summit of the hay mountain. This perilous privilege, so dear to their age and species, had never been granted them before. Their excitement had no bounds. They could talk of nothing but this epoch-making adventure now. But misfortune overtook Susie on the very morning of the important day. In a sudden outbreak of passion, she corrected Clara, with a shovel or a stick or something of the sort. At any rate, the offense committed was of a gravity clearly beyond the limit allowed in the nursery. In accordance with the rule and custom of the house, Susie went to her mother to confess and to help decide upon the size and character of the punishment due. It was quite understood that, as a punishment could have but one rational object and function, to act as a reminder and warn the transgressor against transgressing in the same way again, the children would know about as well as any how to choose a penalty which would be rememberable and effective. Susie and her mother discussed various punishments, but none of them seemed adequate. This fault was an unusually serious one and required the setting up of a danger signal in the memory that would not blow out nor burn out, but remain a fixture there and furnish its saving warning indefinitely. Among the punishments mentioned was deprivation of the hay wagon ride. It was noticeable that this one hit Susie hard. Finally, in the summing up, the mother named over the list and asked, "Which one do you think it ought to be, Susie?" Susie studied, shrank from her duty, and asked, "Which do you think, Mama?" "Well, Susie, I would rather leave it to you. You make the choice yourself." It cost Susie a struggle, and much and deep thinking and weighing, but she came out where anyone who knew her could have foretold she would. "Well, Mama, I'll make it the hay wagon, because you know the other things might not make me remember not to do it again. But if I don't get to ride on the hay wagon, I can remember it easily." In this world, the real penalty, the sharp one, the lasting one, never falls otherwise than on the wrong person. It was not I that corrected Clara, but the remembrance of poor Susie's lost hayride still brings me a pang, after 26 years. Apparently, Susie was born with humane feelings for the animals and compassion for their troubles. This enabled her to see a new point in an old story once when she was only 6 years old, a point which had been overlooked by older and perhaps duller people for many ages. Her mother told her the moving story of the sale of Joseph by his brethren, the staining of his coat with the blood of the slaughtered kid, and the rest of it. She dwelt upon the inhumanity of the brothers, their cruelty toward their helpless young brother, and the unbrotherly treachery which they practiced upon him, for she hoped to teach the child a lesson in gentle pity and mercifulness, which she would remember. Apparently her desire was accomplished, for the tears came into Susie's eyes, and she was deeply moved. Then she said, "Poor little kid!" A child's frank envy of the privileges and distinctions of its elders is often a delicately flattering attention and the reverse of unwelcome, but sometimes the envy is not placed where the beneficiary is expecting it to be placed. Once when Susie was 7, she sat breathlessly absorbed in watching a guest of ours adorn herself for a ball. The lady was charmed by this homage, this mute and gentle admiration, and was happy in it. And when her pretty labors were finished and she stood at last perfect, unimprovable, clothed like Solomon in his glory, she paused, confident and expectant, to receive from Susie's tongue the tribute that was burning in her eyes. Susie drew an envious little sigh and said, "I wish I could have crooked teeth and spectacles." Once, when Susie was 6 months along in her eighth year, she did something one day in the presence of company which subjected her to criticism and reproof. Afterward, when she was alone with her mother, as was her custom, she reflected a little while over the matter. Then she set up what I think, and what the shade of Burns would think, was a quite good philosophical defense. "Well, Mama, you know I didn't see myself, and so I couldn't know how it looked." In homes where the near friends and visitors are mainly literary people, lawyers, judges, authors, professors, and clergymen, the children's ears become early familiarized with wide vocabularies. It is natural for them to pick up any words that fall in their way. It is natural for them to pick up big and little ones indiscriminately. It is natural for them to use without fear any word that comes to their net, no matter how formidable it may be as to size. As a result, their talk is a curious and funny musketry clatter of little words, interrupted at intervals by the heavy artillery crash of a word of such imposing sound and size that it seems to shake the ground and rattle the windows. Sometimes the child gets a wrong idea of a word which it has picked up by chance and attaches to it a meaning which impairs its usefulness, but this does not happen as often as one might expect it would. Indeed, it happens with an infrequency which may be regarded as remarkable. As a child, Susie had good fortune with her large words, and she employed many of them. She made no more than her fair share of mistakes. Once, when she thought something very funny was going to happen, but it didn't, she was racked and torn with laughter by anticipation. But apparently she still felt sure of her position, for she said, "If it had happened, I should have been transported, with glee." And earlier, when she was a little maid of 5 years, she informed a visitor that she had been in a church only once, and that was the time when Clara was christened. In Heidelberg, when she was 6, she noticed that the Schloss Gardens... Dear me, how remote things do come together. I break off that sentence to remark that at a luncheon uptown yesterday, I reminded the hostess that she had not made me acquainted with all the guests. She said yes, she was aware of that, that by request of one of the ladies she had left me to guess that lady out for myself, that I had known that lady for a day more than a quarter of a century ago, and that the lady was desirous of finding out how long it would take me to dig her up out of my memory. The rest of the company were in the game and were anxious to see whether I would succeed or fail. It seemed to me, as the time drifted along, that I was never going to be able to locate that woman, but at last, when the luncheon was nearly finished, a discussion broke out as to where the most comfortable hotel in the world was to be found. Various hotels on the several sides of the ocean were mentioned, and at last somebody reminded her that she had not put forward a preference yet, and she was asked to name the hotel that she thought was, from her point of view, the most satisfactory and comfortable hotel on the planet, and she said promptly, "The Slosh at Heidelberg." I said at once, "I am sincerely glad to meet you again, Mrs. Jones, after this long stretch of years, but you were Miss Smith in those days. Have I located you?" "Yes," she said, "you have." I knew I had. During that day at Heidelberg, so many years ago, many charitable people tried furtively to get that young Miss Smith to adopt the prevailing pronunciation of Schloss by saying Schloss softly and casually every time she said Slosh. But nobody succeeded in converting her, and I knew perfectly well that this was that same old Smith girl, because there could not be two persons on this planet at one and the same time who could preserve and stick to a mispronunciation like that for nearly a generation. As I was saying, when I interrupted myself, in Heidelberg, when Susie was 6, she noticed that the Schloss Gardens were populous with snails creeping all about everywhere. One day she found a new dish on her table and inquired concerning it and learned that it was made of snails. She was awed and impressed and said, "Wild ones, Mama?" She was thoughtful and considerate of others, an acquired quality, no doubt. No one seems to be born with it. One hot day at home in Hartford, when she was a little child, her mother borrowed her fan several times, a Japanese one, value 5 cents, refreshed herself with it a moment or two, then handed it back with a word of thanks. Susie knew that her mother would use the fan all the time if she could do it without putting a deprivation upon its owner. She also knew that her mother could not be persuaded to do that. A relief must be devised somehow. Susie devised it. She got 5 cents out of her money box and carried it to Patrick and asked him to take it downtown, a mile and a half, and buy a Japanese fan and bring it home. He did it, and thus thoughtfully and delicately was the exigency met and the mother's comfort secured. It is to the child's credit that she did not save herself expense by bringing down another and more costly kind of fan from upstairs, but was content to act upon the impression that her mother desired the Japanese kind, content to accomplish the desire and stop with that, without troubling about the wisdom or unwisdom of it. Sometimes, while she was still a child, her speech fell into quaint and strikingly expressive forms. Once, aged 9 or 10, she came to her mother's room when her sister Jean was a baby, and said Jean was crying in the nursery, and asked if she might ring for the nurse. Her mother asked, "Is she crying hard?" meaning cross, ugly. "Well, no, Mama. It is a weary, lonesome cry." It is a pleasure to me to recall various incidents which reveal the delicacies of feeling which were so considerable a part of her budding character. Such a revelation came once in a way which, while creditable to her heart, was defective in another direction. She was in her 11th year then. Her mother had been making the Christmas purchases, and she allowed Susie to see the presents which were for Patrick's children. Among these was a handsome sled for Jimmy, on which a stag was painted. Also in gilt capitals the word Deer, D-E-E-R. Susie was excited and joyous over everything until she came to this sled. Then she became sober and silent. Yet the sled was the choicest of all the gifts. Her mother was surprised and also disappointed and said, "Why, Susie, doesn't it please you? Isn't it fine?" Susie hesitated, and it was plain that she did not want to say the thing that was in her mind. However, being urged, she brought it haltingly out. "Well, Mama, it is fine, and of course it did cost a good deal, but why should that be mentioned?" Seeing that she was not understood, she reluctantly pointed to the word "dear." It was her orthography that was at fault, not her heart. She had inherited both from her mother. The ability to spell is a natural gift. The person not born with it can never become perfect in it. I was always able to spell correctly. My wife and her sister, Mrs. Crane, were always bad spellers. Once when Clara was a little chap, her mother was away from home for a few days, and Clara wrote her a small letter every day. When her mother returned, she praised Clara's letters. Then she said, "But in one of them, Clara, you spelled a word wrong." Clara said with quite unconscious brutality, "Why, Mama, how did you know?" More than a quarter of a century has elapsed, and Mrs. Crane is under our roof here in New York for a few days. Her head is white now, but she is as pretty and winning and sweet as she was in those ancient times at her quarry farm, where she was an idol and the rest of us were the worshippers. Her gift of imperfect orthography remains unimpaired. She writes a great many letters. This was always a passion of hers. She was never able to live happily unless she could see that incomparable orthography flowing from her pen. Yesterday she asked me how to spell New Jersey, and I knew by her look, after she got the information, that she was regretting she hadn't asked somebody years ago. The miracles which she and her sister, Mrs. Clemens, were able to perform without help of dictionary or spelling book are incredible. During the year of my engagement, 1869, while I was out on the lecture platform, the daily letter that came from me generally brought me news from the front, by which expression I refer to the internecine war that was always going on in a friendly way between these two orthographists about the spelling of words. One of these words was scissors. They never seemed to consult a dictionary. They always wanted something or somebody that was more reliable. Between them, they had spelled scissors in 7 different ways, a feat which I am certain no person now living, educated or uneducated, can match. I have forgotten how I was required to say which of the 7 ways was the right one. I couldn't do it. If there had been 14 ways, none of them would have been right. I remember only one of the instances offered. The other 6 have passed from my memory. That one was Sicisiors, S-I-C-I-S-I-O-R-S. That way of spelling it looked so reasonable, so plausible to the discoverer of it, that I was hardly believed when I decided against it. Mrs. Crane keeps by her to this day a little book of about 30 pages of notepaper, on which she has written in a large hand words which she needs to use in her letters every day, words which the cat could spell without prompting or tuition, and yet are words which Mrs. Crane never allows herself to risk upon paper without looking at that vocabulary of hers each time to make certain. During my engagement year, 37 years ago, a considerable company of young people amused themselves in the Langdon homestead one night with the game of verbarium, which was brand new at the time and very popular. A text word was chosen, and each person wrote that word in large letters across the top of a sheet of paper, then sat with pencil in hand and ready to begin as soon as game was called. The player could begin with the first letter of that text word, and build words out of the text word during 2 minutes by the watch. But he must not use a letter that was not in the text word, and he must not use any letter in the text word twice, unless the letter occurred twice in the text word. I remember the first bout that we had at that game. The text word was California. When game was called, everybody began to set down words as fast as he could make his pencil move. Corn, car, cone, and so on. Digging out the shortest words first because they could be set down more quickly than the longer ones. When the 2 minutes were up, the scores were examined, and the prize went to the person who had achieved the largest number of words. The good scores ranged along between 30 and 50 or 60 words. But Mrs. Crane would not allow her score to be examined. She was plainly doubtful about getting that prize. But when persuasion failed to avail, we chased her about the place, captured her, and took her score away from her by force. She had achieved only one word, and that was calf, C-A-L-F, which she had spelled C-A-F-F, and she never would have gotten even that one word, honestly. She had to introduce a letter that didn't belong in the text word in order to get it. Tuesday, February 6th, 1906. Playing the Prince and the Pauper, acting charades, etc. When Susie was 12 and a half years old, I took to the platform again, after a long absence from it, and raked the country for 4 months in company with George W. Cable. Early in November, we gave a reading one night in Chickering Hall in New York, and when I was walking home in a dull gloom of fog and rain, I heard one invisible man say to another invisible man, this in substance, General Grant has actually concluded to write his autobiography. That remark gave me joy at the time, but if I had been struck by lightning in place of it, it would have been better for me and mine. However, that is a long story, and this is not the place for it. To Susie, as to all Americans, General Grant was the supremest of heroes, and she longed for a sight of him. I took her to see him one day. However, let that go. It belongs elsewhere. I will return to it by and by. In the midst of our reading campaign, I returned to Hartford from the far west, reaching home one evening just at dinner time. I was expecting to have a happy and restful season by a hickory fire in the library with the family, but was required to go at once to George Warner's house, 150 yards away, across the grounds. This was a heavy disappointment, and I tried to beg off, but did not succeed. I couldn't even find out why I must waste this precious evening in a visit to a friend's house when our own house offered so many and superior advantages. There was a mystery somewhere, but I was not able to get to the bottom of it. So we tramped across in the snow, and I found the Warner drawing room crowded with seated people. There was a vacancy in the front row, for me, in front of a curtain. At once the curtain was drawn, and before me, properly costumed, was the little maid, Margaret Warner, clothed in Tom Canty's rags. And beyond an intercepting railing was Susie Clemens, arrayed in the silks and satins of the prince. Then followed with good action and spirit the rest of that first meeting between the prince and the pauper. It was a charming surprise, and to me a moving one. Other episodes of the tale followed, and I have seldom in my life enjoyed an evening so much as I enjoyed that one. This lovely surprise was my wife's work. She had patched the scenes together from the book and had trained the 6 or 8 young actors in their parts, and had also designed and furnished the costumes. Afterward, I added a part for myself, Miles Hendon, also a part for Katie and a part for George. I think I have not mentioned George before. He was a colored man, the children's darling, and a remarkable person. He had been a member of the family a number of years at that time. He had been born a slave in Maryland, and was set free by the proclamation when he was just entering young manhood. He was a body servant to General Devens all through the war, and then had come north and for 8 or 10 years had been earning his living by odd jobs. He came out to our house once, an entire stranger, to clean some windows, and remained 18 years. Mrs. Clemens could always tell enough about a servant by the look of him, more, in fact, than she or anybody else could tell about him by his recommendations. We played The Prince and the Pauper a number of times in our house to seated audiences of 84 persons, which was the limit of our space, and we got great entertainment out of it. As we played the piece, it had several superiorities over the play as presented on the public stage in England and America, for we always had both the prince and the pauper on deck, whereas these parts were always doubled on the public stage, an economical but unwise departure from the book because it necessitated the excision of the strongest and most telling of the episodes. We made a stirring and handsome thing out of the coronation scene. This could not be accomplished otherwise than by having both the prince and the pauper present at the same time. Clara was the little Lady Jane Grey, and she performed the part with electrifying spirit. Twitchell's littlest cub, now a grave and reverend clergyman, was a page. He was so small that people on the back seats could not see him without an opera glass, but he held up Lady Jane's train very well. Jean was only something past 3 years old, therefore was too young to have a part, but she produced the whole piece every day independently and played all the parts herself. For a one-actor piece, it was not bad. In fact, it was very good, very entertaining. For she was in very deep earnest, and besides, she used an English which none but herself could handle with effect. Our children and the neighbors' children played well, easily, comfortably, naturally, and with high spirit. How was it that they were able to do this? It was because they had been in training all the time from their infancy. They grew up in our house, so to speak, playing charades. We never made any preparation. We selected a word, whispered the parts of it to the little actors, then we retired to the hall, where all sorts of costumery had been laid out ready for the evening. We dressed the parts in 3 minutes, and each detachment marched into the library and performed its syllable, then retired, leaving the fathers and mothers to guess that syllable if they could. Sometimes they could. Will Gillette, now world-famous actor and dramatist, learned a part of his trade by acting in our charades. Those little chaps, Susie and Clara, invented charades themselves in their earliest years and played them for the entertainment of their mother and me. They had one high merit. None but a high-grade intellect could guess them. Obscurity is a great thing in a charade. These babies invented one once which was a masterpiece in this regard. They came in and played the first syllable, which was a conversation in which the word red occurred with suggestive frequency. Then they retired, came again, continuing an angry dispute which they had begun outside, and in which several words like just, fair, unfair, unjust, and so on kept occurring. But we noticed that the word just was in the majority, so we set that down along with the word red and discussed the probabilities while the children went out to recostume themselves. We had thus red, just. They soon appeared and began to do a very fashionable morning call in which the one made many inquiries of the other concerning some lady whose name was persistently suppressed and who was always referred to as her, even when the grammar did not permit that form of the pronoun. The children retired. We took an account of stock, and so far as we could see, we had 3 syllables, red, just, her. But that was all. The combination did not seem to throw any real glare on the future completed word. The children arrived again and stooped down and began to chat and quarrel and carry on and fumble and fuss at the register. Read just her. With the exception of myself, this family was never strong on spelling. In the Prince and the Pauper days, and earlier and later, especially later, Susie and her nearest neighbor, Margaret Warner, often devised tragedies and played them in the schoolroom with little Jean's help, with closed doors, no admission to anybody. The chief characters were always a couple of queens, with a quarrel in stock, historical when possible, but a quarrel anyway, even if it had to be a work of the imagination. Jean always had one function, only one. She sat at a little table about a foot high and drafted death warrants for these queens to sign. In the course of time, they completely wore out Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots, also all of Mrs. Clemens's gowns that they could get hold of, for nothing charmed these monarchs like having 4 or 5 feet of gown dragging on the floor behind. Mrs. Clemens and I spied upon them more than once, which was treacherous conduct, but I don't think we very seriously minded that. It was grand to see the queens stride back and forth and reproach each other in three or four syllable words dripping with blood, and it was pretty to see how tranquil Jean was through it all. Familiarity with daily death and carnage had hardened her to crime and suffering in all their forms, and they were no longer able to hasten her pulse by a beat. Sometimes, when there was a long interval between death warrants, she even leaned her head on her table and went to sleep. It was then a curious spectacle of innocent repose and crimson and volcanic tragedy. 2 or 3 weeks ago, when I sat talking with the divine Sarah the illustrious, the unapproachable, and I was trading English for her French, and neither of us making wages at it, she could have detected a strong but faraway interest in my eyes if she had examined closely, for while I was seeing her, I was also seeing another Sarah Bernhardt of long years ago, Susie Clemens. Susie had seen the Bernhardt play once, and always after that she was fond of doing impassioned imitations of her great heroine's tragic parts. She did them strikingly well, too. Wednesday, February 7th, 1906. Susie Clemens's biography of her father, Mr. Clemens's opinion of critics, etc. When Susie was 13 and was a slender little maid with plaited tails of copper-tinged brown hair down her back and was perhaps the busiest bee in the household hive, by reason of the manifold studies, health exercises, and recreations she had to attend to, she secretly, and of her own motion and out of love, added another task to her labors, the writing of a biography of me. She did this work in her bedroom at night and kept her record hidden. After a little, the mother discovered it and filched it and let me see it, then told Susie what she had done and how pleased I was and how proud. I remember that time with a deep pleasure. I'd had compliments before, but none that touched me like this, none that could approach it for value in my eyes. It has kept that place always since. I have had no compliment, no praise, no tribute from any source that was so precious to me as this one was and still is. As I read it now, after all these many years, it is still a king's message to me, and brings me the same dear surprise it brought me then, with the pathos added of the thought that the eager and hasty hand that sketched it and scrawled it will not touch mine again. And I feel as the humble and unexpectant must feel when their eyes fall upon the edict that raises them to the ranks of the noble. Yesterday, while I was rummaging in a pile of ancient notebooks of mine which I had not seen for years, I came across a reference to that biography. It is quite evident that several times, at breakfast and dinner in those long past days, I was posing for the biography. In fact, I clearly remember that I was doing that, and I also remember that Susie detected it. I remember saying a very smart thing, with a good deal of an air, at the breakfast table one morning, and that Susie observed to her mother privately a little later that Papa was doing that for the biography. I cannot bring myself to change any line or word in Susie's sketch of me, but will introduce passages from it now and then, just as they came in their quaint simplicity out of her honest heart, which was the beautiful heart of a child. What comes from that source has a charm and grace of its own which may transgress all the recognized laws of literature, if it choose, and yet be literature still, and worthy of hospitality. I shall print the whole of this little biography before I am done with it, every word, every sentence. The spelling is frequently desperate, but it was Susie's, and it shall stand. I love it and cannot profane it. To me it is gold. To correct it would alloy it, not refine it. It would spoil it. It would take from it its freedom and flexibility and make it stiff and formal. Even when it is most extravagant, I am not shocked. It is Susie's spelling, and she was doing the best she could, and nothing could better it for me. She learned languages easily. She learned history easily. She learned music easily. She learned all things easily, quickly, and thoroughly, except spelling. She even learned that after a while, but it would have grieved me but little if she had failed in it. For although good spelling was my one accomplishment, I was never able to greatly respect it. When I was a schoolboy 60 years ago, we had 2 prizes in our school. One was for good spelling, the other for amiability. These things were thin, smooth, silver discs about the size of a dollar. Upon the one was engraved in flowing Italian script the words, "Good spelling." On the other was engraved the word amiability. The holders of these prizes hung them about the neck with a string, and those holders were the envy of the whole school. There wasn't a pupil that wouldn't have given a leg for the privilege of wearing one of them a week, but no pupil ever got a chance except John Robards and me. John Robards was eternally and indestructibly amiable. I may even say devilishly amiable, fiendishly amiable, exasperatingly amiable. That was the sort of feeling that we had about that quality of his. So he always wore the amiability medal. I always wore the other medal. That word always is a trifle too strong. We lost the medals several times. It was because they became so monotonous. We needed a change. Therefore, several times we traded medals. It was a satisfaction to John Robards to seem to be a good speller, which he wasn't, and it was a satisfaction to me to seem to be amiable for a change. But of course these changes could not long endure, for some schoolmate or other would presently notice what had been happening, and that schoolmate would not have been human if he had lost any time in reporting this treason. The teacher took the medals away from us at once, of course, and we always had them back again before Friday night. If we lost the medals Monday morning, John's amiability was at the top of the list Friday afternoon when the teacher came to square up the week's account. The Friday afternoon session always closed with spelling down. Being in disgrace, I necessarily started at the foot of my division of spellers, but I always slaughtered both divisions and stood alone with the medal around my neck when the campaign was finished. I did miss on a word once, just at the end of one of these conflicts, and so lost the medal. I left the first R out of February, but that was to accommodate a sweetheart. My passion was so strong just at that time that I would have left out the whole alphabet if the word had contained it. As I have said before, I never had any large respect for good spelling. That is my feeling yet. Before the spelling book came with its arbitrary forms, men unconsciously revealed shades of their characters, and also added enlightening shades of expression to what they wrote by their spelling. And so it is possible that the spelling book has been a doubtful benevolence to us. Susie began the biography in 1885, when I was in the 50th year of my age. She begins in this way. We are a very happy family. We consist of Papa, Mama, Jean, Clara, and me. It is Papa I am writing about, and I shall have no trouble in not knowing what to say about him, as he is a very striking character. But wait a minute. I will return to Susie presently. In the matter of slavish imitation, man is the monkey's superior all the time. The average man is destitute of independence of opinion. He is not interested in contriving an opinion of his own by study and reflection, but is only anxious to find out what his neighbor's opinion is and slavishly adopt it. A generation ago, I found out that the latest review of a book was pretty sure to be just a reflection of the earliest review of it, that whatever the first reviewer found to praise or censure in the book would be repeated in the latest reviewer's report, with nothing fresh added. Therefore, more than once I took the precaution of sending my book in manuscript to Mr. Howells when he was editor of the Atlantic Monthly, so that he could prepare a review of it at leisure. I knew he would say the truth about the book. I also knew that he would find more merit than demerit in it, because I already knew that that was the condition of the book. I allowed no copy of it to go out to the press until after Mr. Howells's notice of it had appeared. That book was always safe. There wasn't a man behind a pen in all America that had the courage to find anything in the book which Mr. Howells had not found. There wasn't a man behind a pen in America that had spirit enough to say a brave and original thing about the book on his own responsibility. I believe that the trade of critic, in literature, music, and the drama, is the most degraded of all trades, and that it has no real value, certainly no large value. When Charles Dudley Warner and I were about to bring out The Gilded Age, the editor of the Daily Graphic persuaded me to let him have an advance copy, he giving me his word of honor that no notice of it would appear in his paper until after the Atlantic Monthly notice should have appeared. This reptile published a review of the book within 3 days afterward. I could not really complain, because he had only given me his word of honor as security. I ought to have required of him something substantial. I believe his notice did not deal mainly with the merit of the book or the lack of it, but with my moral attitude toward the public. It was charged that I had used my reputation to play a swindle upon the public, that Mr. Warner had written as much as half of the book, and that I had used my name to float it and give it currency. A currency, so the critic averred, which it could not have acquired without my name, and that this conduct of mine was a grave fraud upon the people. The Graphic was not an authority upon any subject whatever. It had a sort of distinction, in that it was the first and only illustrated daily newspaper that the world had seen, but it was without character. It was poorly and cheaply edited. Its opinion of a book or of any other work of art was of no consequence. Everybody knew this, yet all the critics in America, one after the other, copied the Graphic's criticism, merely changing the phraseology, and left me under that charge of dishonest conduct. Even the great Chicago Tribune, the most important journal in the Middle West, was not able to invent anything fresh, but adopted the view of the humble Daily Graphic, dishonesty charge and all. However, let it go. It is the will of God that we must have critics, and missionaries, and congressmen, and humorists, and we must bear the burden. Meantime, I seem to have been drifting into criticism myself, but that is nothing. At the worst, criticism is nothing more than a crime, and I am not unused to that. What I have been traveling toward all this time is this. The first critic that ever had occasion to describe my personal appearance littered his description with foolish and inexcusable errors, whose aggregate furnished the result that I was distinctly and distressingly unhandsome. That description floated around the country in the papers and was in constant use and wear for a quarter of a century. It seems strange to me that apparently no critic in the country could be found who could look at me and have the courage to take up his pen and destroy that lie. That lie began its course on the Pacific coast in 1864, and it likened me in personal appearance to Petroleum V. Nasby, who had been out there lecturing. For 25 years afterward, no critic could furnish a description of me without fetching in Nasby to help out my portrait. I knew Nasby well, and he was a good fellow, but in my life I have not felt malignant enough about any more than 3 persons to charge those persons with resembling Nasby. It hurts me to the heart, these things. To this day it hurts me to the heart. I was always handsome. Anybody but a critic could have seen it. And it had long been a distress to my family, including Susie, that the critics should go on making this wearisome mistake year after year, when there was no foundation for it. Even when a critic wanted to be particularly friendly and complimentary to me, he didn't dare to go beyond my clothes. He never ventured beyond that old safe frontier. When he had finished with my clothes, he had said all the kind things, the pleasant things, the complimentary things he could risk. Then he dropped back on Nasby. Yesterday, I found this clipping in the pocket of one of those ancient memorandum books of mine. It is of the date of 39 years ago, and both the paper and the ink are yellow with the bitterness that I felt in that old day when I clipped it out to preserve it and brood over it and grieve about it. I will copy it here, to wit. A correspondent of the Philadelphia Press, writing of one of Schuyler Colfax's receptions, says of our Washington correspondent, "Mark Twain, the delicate humorist, was present. Quite a lion, as he deserves to be. Mark is a bachelor, faultless in taste, whose snowy vest is suggestive of endless quarrels with Washington washerwomen. But the heroism of Mark is settled for all time, for such purity and smoothness were never seen before. His lavender gloves might have been stolen from some Turkish harem, so delicate were they in size. But more likely, anything else were more likely than that. In form and feature, he bears some resemblance to the immortal Nasby, but whilst Petroleum is brunette to the core, Twain is golden, amber-hued, melting, blonde." Let us return to Susie's biography now and get the opinion of one who is unbiased. Papa's appearance has been described many times, but very incorrectly. He has beautiful gray hair, not any too thick or any too long, but just right. A Roman nose which greatly improves the beauty of his features, kind blue eyes and a small mustache. He has a wonderfully shaped head and profile. He has a very good figure. In short, he is an extraordinarily fine-looking man. All his features are perfect, except that he hasn't extraordinary teeth. His complexion is very fair, and he doesn't wear a beard. He is a very good man and a very funny one. He has got a temper, but we all of us have in this family. He is the loveliest man I ever saw or ever hope to see. And oh, so absent-minded. He does tell perfectly delightful stories. Clara and I used to sit on each arm of his chair and listen while he told us stories about the pictures on the wall. I remember the storytelling days vividly. They were a difficult and exacting audience, those little creatures. Thursday, February 8, 1906. Susie Clemens's biography continued, Romancer to the Children, Incident of the Spoon-Shaped Drive, The Burglar Alarm Does Its Whole Duty. Along one side of the library in the Hartford home, the bookshelves joined the mantelpiece. In fact, there were shelves on both sides of the mantelpiece. On these shelves and on the mantelpiece stood various ornaments. At one end of the procession was a framed oil painting of a cat's head. At the other end was a head of a beautiful young girl, life-size, called Emmeline because she looked just about like that, an impressionist watercolor. Between the one picture and the other, there were 12 or 15 of the bric-a-brac things already mentioned, also an oil painting by Elihu Vedder, The Young Medusa. Every now and then, the children required me to construct a romance, always impromptu, not a moment's preparation permitted, and into that romance I had to get all that bric-a-brac and the three pictures. I had to start always with the cat and finish with Emmeline. I was never allowed the refreshment of a change, end for end. It was not permissible to introduce a bric-a-brac ornament into the story out of its place in the procession. These bric-a-bracs were never allowed a peaceful day, a reposeful day, a restful Sabbath. In their lives there was no Sabbath. In their lives there was no peace. They knew no existence but a monotonous career of violence and bloodshed. In the course of time, the bric-a-brac and the pictures showed wear. It was because they had had so many and such tumultuous adventures in their romantic careers. As Romancer to the Children, I had a hard time even from the beginning. If they brought me a picture in a magazine and required me to build a story to it, they would cover the rest of the page with their pudgy hands to keep me from stealing an idea from it. The stories had to come hot from the bat, always. They had to be absolutely original and fresh. Sometimes the children furnished me simply a character or two, or a dozen, and required me to start out at once on that slim basis and deliver those characters up to a vigorous and entertaining life of crime. If they heard of a new trade or an unfamiliar animal or anything like that, I was pretty sure to have to deal with those things in the next romance. Once Clara required me to build a sudden tale out of a plumber and a bog constrictor, and I had to do it. She didn't know what a boa constrictor was until he developed in the tale. Then she was better satisfied with it than ever. From Susie's biography. Papa's favorite game is billiards, and when he is tired and wishes to rest himself, he stays up all night and plays billiards. It seems to rest his head. He smokes a great deal almost incessantly. He has the mind of an author exactly, some of the simplest things he can't understand. Our burglar alarm is often out of order, and Papa had been obliged to take the mahogany room off from the alarm altogether for a time, because the burglar alarm had been in the habit of ringing even when the mahogany room window was closed. At length he thought that perhaps the burglar alarm might be in order, and he decided to try and see. Accordingly, he put it on and went down and opened the window. Consequently, the alarm bell rang. It would even if the alarm had been in order. Papa went despairingly upstairs and said to Mama, "Livy, the mahogany room won't go on. I've just opened the window to see." "Why, youth," Mama replied, "if you've opened the window, why, of course the alarm will ring." "That's what I've opened it for. Why, I just went down to see if it would ring." Mama tried to explain to Papa that when he wanted to go and see whether the alarm would ring while the window was closed, he mustn't go and open the window. But in vain, Papa couldn't understand and got very impatient with Mama for trying to make him believe an impossible thing true. This is a frank biographer and an honest one. She uses no sandpaper on me. I have to this day the same dull head in the matter of conundrums and perplexities which Susie had discovered in those long-gone days. Complexities annoy me. They irritate me. Then this progressive feeling presently warms into anger. I cannot get far in the reading of the commonest and simplest contract, with its parties of the first part and parties of the second part and parties of the third part, before my temper is all gone. Ashcroft comes up here every day and pathetically tries to make me understand the points of the lawsuit which we are conducting against Henry Butters, Harold Wheeler, and the rest of those plasmon thieves, but daily he has to give it up. It is pitiful to see when he bends his earnest and appealing eyes upon me and says, after one of his efforts, "Now you do understand that, don't you?" I am always obliged to say, "I don't, Ashcroft. I wish I could understand it, but I don't. Send for the cat. In the days which Susie is talking about, a perplexity fell to my lot one day. F.G. Whitmore was my business agent, and he brought me out from town in his buggy. We drove by the porte cochere and toward the stable. Now, this was a single road, and was like a spoon whose handle stretched from the gate to a great round flower bed in the neighborhood of the stable. At the approach to the flower bed, the road divided and circumnavigated it, making a loop, which I have likened to the bowl of the spoon. As we neared the loop, I saw that Whitmore was laying his course to port. I was sitting on the starboard side, the side the house was on, and was going to start around that spoon bowl on the left-hand side. I said, "Don't do that, Whitmore. Take the right-hand side. Then I shall be next to the house when we get to the door." He said, "That will not happen in any case. It doesn't make any difference which way I go around this flower bed." I explained to him that he was an ass, but he stuck to his proposition, and I said, "Go on and try it and see." He went on and tried it, and sure enough, he fetched me up at the door on the very side that he had said I would be. I was not able to believe it then, and I don't believe it yet. I said, "Whitmore, that is merely an accident. You can't do it again." He said he could, and he drove down into the street, fetched around, came back, and actually did it again. I was stupefied, paralyzed, petrified with these strange results, but they did not convince me. I didn't believe he could do it another time, but he did. He said he could do it all day and fetch up the same way every time. By that time, my temper was gone, and I asked him to go home and apply to the asylum, and I would pay the expenses. I didn't want to see him anymore for a week. I went upstairs in a rage and started to tell Livy about it, expecting to get her sympathy for me and to breed aversion in her for Whitmore, but she merely burst into peal after peal of laughter as the tale of my adventure went on, for her head was like Susie's. Riddles and complexities had no terrors for it. Her mind and Susie's were analytical. I've tried to make it appear that mine was different. Many and many a time I have told that buggy experiment, hoping against hope that I would sometime or other find somebody who would be on my side, but it has never happened. And I am never able to go glibly forward and state the circumstances of that buggy's progress without having to halt and consider and call up in my mind the spoon handle, the bowl of the spoon, the buggy and the horse, and my position in the buggy. And the minute I have got that far and try to turn it to the left, it goes to ruin. I can't see how it is ever going to fetch me out right when we get to the door. Susie is right in her estimate. I can't understand things. That burglar alarm which Susie mentions led a gay and careless life and had no principles. It was generally out of order at one point or another. And there was plenty of opportunity because all the windows and doors in the house, from the cellar up to the top floor, were connected with it. However, in its seasons of being out of order, it could trouble us for only a very little while. We quickly found out that it was fooling us, and that it was buzzing its blood-curdling alarm merely for its own amusement. Then we would shut it off and send to New York for the electrician, there not being one in all Hartford in those days. When the repairs were finished, we would set the alarm again and re-establish our confidence in it. It never did any real business except upon one single occasion. All the rest of its expensive career was frivolous and without purpose. Just that one time it performed its duty and its whole duty, gravely, seriously, admirably. It let fly about 2 o'clock one black and dreary March morning, and I turned out promptly because I knew that it was not fooling this time. The bathroom door was on my side of the bed. I stepped in there, turned up the gas, looked at the annunciator, and turned off the alarm, so far as the door indicated was concerned, thus stopping the racket. Then I came back to bed. Mrs. Clemens opened the debate. "What was it?" "It was the cellar door." "Was it a burglar, do you think?" "Yes," I said, "of course it was. Did you suppose it was a Sunday school superintendent?" "No. What do you suppose he wants?" "I suppose he wants jewelry, but he is not acquainted with the house, and he thinks it is in the cellar. I don't like to disappoint a burglar whom I am not acquainted with and who has done me no harm, but if he had had common sagacity enough to inquire, I could have told him we kept nothing down there but coal and vegetables. Still, it may be that he is acquainted with this place, and that what he really wants is coal and vegetables. On the whole, I think it is vegetables he is after." "Are you going down to see?" "No, I could not be of any assistance. Let him select for himself. I don't know where the things are." Then she said, But suppose he comes up to the ground floor? That's all right. We shall know it the minute he opens the door on that floor. It will set off the alarm. Just then the terrific buzzing broke out again. I said, "He has arrived. I told you he would. I know all about burglars and their ways. They are systematic people." I went into the bathroom to see if I was right, and I was. I shut off the dining room and stopped the buzzing and came back to bed. My wife said, "What do you suppose he is after now?" I said, "I think he has got all the vegetables he wants and is coming up for napkin rings and odds and ends for the wife and children. They all have families, burglars have, and they are always thoughtful of them, always take a few necessaries of life for themselves and fill out with tokens of remembrance for the family. In taking them, they do not forget us. Those very things represent tokens of his remembrance of us, and also of our remembrance of him. We never get them again. The memory of the attention remains embalmed in our hearts." "Are you going down to see what it is he wants now?" "No," I said. "I'm no more interested than I was before. They are experienced people, burglars. They know what they want. I should be no help to him. I think he is after ceramics and bric-a-brac and such things. If he knows the house, he knows that that is all he can find on the dining room floor." She said, with a strong interest perceptible in her tone, "Suppose he comes up here." I said, "It's all right. He will give us notice." "What shall we do then?" "Climb out of the window." She said a little restively, "Well, what is the use of a burglar alarm for us?" "You have seen, dear heart, that it has been useful up to the present moment, and I have explained to you how it will be continuously useful after he gets up here." That was the end of it. He didn't ring any more alarms. Presently I said, "He is disappointed, I think. He has gone off with the vegetables and the bric-a-brac, and I think he is dissatisfied." We went to sleep, and at a quarter before 8 in the morning I was out and hurrying, for I was to take the 8:29 train for New York. I found the gas burning brightly, full head, all over the first floor. My new overcoat was gone, my old umbrella was gone, my new patent leather shoes, which I had never worn, were gone. The large window which opened into the ombra at the rear of the house was standing wide. I passed out through it and tracked the burglar down the hill through the trees, tracked him without difficulty, because he had blazed his progress with imitation silver napkin rings and my umbrella and various other things which he had disapproved of. And I went back in triumph and proved to my wife that he was a disappointed burglar. I had suspected he would be from the start, and from his not coming up to our floor to get human beings. Things happened to me that day in New York. I will tell about them another time. From Susie's biography. Papa has a peculiar gait we like. It seems just to suit him, but most people do not. He always walks up and down the room while thinking and between each course at meals. A lady distantly related to us came to visit us once in those days. She came to stay a week, but all our efforts to make her happy failed. We could not imagine why, and she got up her anchor and sailed the next morning. We did much guessing, but could not solve the mystery. Later, we found out what the trouble was. It was my tramping up and down between the courses. She conceived the idea that I could not stand her society. That word youth, as the reader has perhaps already guessed, was my wife's pet name for me. It was gently satirical, but also affectionate. I had certain mental and material peculiarities and customs proper to a much younger person than I was. From Susie's biography. Papa is very fond of animals, particularly of cats. We had a dear little gray kitten once that he named Lazy. Papa always wears gray to match his hair and eyes. And he would carry him around on his shoulder. It was a mighty pretty sight. The gray cat sound asleep against Papa's gray coat and hair. The names that he has given our different cats are really remarkably funny. They are namely Stray Kit, Abner, Motley, Fräulein, Lazy, Buffalo Bill, Soapy Sal, Cleveland, Sour Mash, and Pestilence and Famine. At one time when the children were small, we had a very black mother cat named Satan, and Satan had a small black offspring named Sin. Pronouns were a difficulty for the children. Little Clara came in one day, her black eyes snapping with indignation, and said, "Papa, Satan ought to be punished. She is out there at the greenhouse, and there she stays and stays, and his kitten is downstairs crying." From Susie's biography. Papa uses very strong language, but I have an idea not nearly so strong as when he first married Mama. A lady acquaintance of his is rather apt to interrupt what one is saying, and Papa told Mama that he thought he should say to the lady's husband, "I am glad Susie Warner wasn't present when the deity said, 'Let there be light.'" It is as I've said before. This is a frank historian. She doesn't cover up one's deficiencies, but gives them an equal showing with one's handsomer qualities. Of course I made the remark, which she has quoted, and even at this distant day I am still as much as half persuaded that if Susie Warner had been present when the Creator said, "Let there be light," she would have interrupted him and we shouldn't ever have got it. From Susie's biography. Papa said the other day, "I am a mugwump, and a mugwump is pure from the marrow out." Papa knows that I am writing this biography of him, and he said this for it. He doesn't like to go to church at all, why I never understood, until just now. He told us the other day that he couldn't bear to hear anyone talk but himself, but that he could listen to himself talk for hours without getting tired. Of course, he said this in joke, but I've no doubt it was founded on truth. Friday, February 9th, 1906. The strong language episode in the bathroom, Susie's reference to the Prince and the Pauper, the mother and the children help edit the books, reference to ancestors. Susie's remark about my strong language troubles me, and I must go back to it. All through the first 10 years of my married life, I kept a constant and discreet watch upon my tongue while in the house, and went outside into a distance when circumstances were too much for me and I was obliged to seek relief. I prized my wife's respect and approval above all the rest of the human race's respect and approval. I dreaded the day when she should discover that I was but a whited sepulchre partly freighted with suppressed language. I was so careful during 10 years that I had not a doubt that my suppressions had been successful. Therefore, I was quite as happy in my guilt as I could have been if I had been innocent. But at last, an accident exposed me. I went into the bathroom one morning to make my toilet and carelessly left the door 2 or 3 inches ajar. It was the first time that I'd ever failed to take the precaution of closing it tightly. I knew the necessity of being particular about this because shaving was always a trying ordeal for me, and I could seldom carry it through to a finish without verbal helps. Now, this time I was unprotected, but did not suspect it. I had no extraordinary trouble with my razor on this occasion, and was able to worry through with mere mutterings and growlings of an improper sort, but with nothing noisy or emphatic about them, no snapping and barking. Then I put on a shirt. My shirts are an invention of my own. They open in the back and are buttoned there, when there are buttons. This time the button was missing. My temper jumped up several degrees in a moment, and my remarks rose accordingly, both in loudness and vigor of expression. But I was not troubled, for the bathroom door was a solid one, and I supposed it was firmly closed. I flung up the window and threw the shirt out. It fell upon the shrubbery, where the people on their way to church could admire it if they wanted to. There was merely 50 feet of grass between the shirt and the passer-by. Still rumbling and thundering distantly, I put on another shirt. Again, the button was absent. I augmented my language to meet the emergency and threw that shirt out of the window. I was too angry, too insane, to examine the third shirt, but put it furiously on. Again, the button was absent, and that shirt followed its comrades out of the window. Then I straightened up, gathered my reserves, and let myself go like a cavalry charge. In the midst of that great assault, my eye fell upon that gaping door, and I was paralyzed. It took me a good while to finish my toilet. I extended the time unnecessarily in trying to make up my mind as to what I would best do in the circumstances. I tried to hope that Mrs. Clemens was asleep, but I knew better. I could not escape by the window. It was narrow and suited only to shirts. At last I made up my mind to boldly loaf through the bedroom with the air of a person who had not been doing anything. I made half the journey successfully. I did not turn my eyes in her direction because that would not be safe. It is very difficult to look as if you had not been doing anything when the facts are the other way, and my confidence in my performance oozed steadily out of me as I went along. I was aiming for the left-hand door because it was furthest from my wife. It had never been opened from the day that the house was built, but it seemed a blessed refuge for me now. The bed was this one, wherein I am lying now and dictating these histories morning after morning with so much serenity. It was the same old elaborately carved black Venetian bedstead, the most comfortable bedstead that ever was, with space enough in it for a family, and carved angels enough surmounting its twisted columns and its headboard and footboard to bring peace to the sleepers and pleasant dreams. I had to stop in the middle of the room. I hadn't the strength to go on. I believed that I was under accusing eyes, that even the carved angels were inspecting me with an unfriendly gaze. You know how it is when you are convinced that somebody behind you is looking steadily at you. You have to turn your face. You can't help it. I turned mine. The bed was placed as it is now, with the foot where the head ought to be. If it had been placed as it should have been, the high headboard would have sheltered me. But the footboard was no sufficient protection, for I could be seen over it. I was exposed. I was wholly without protection. I turned because I couldn't help it. And my memory of what I saw is still vivid after all these years. Against the white pillows I saw the black head. I saw that young and beautiful face, and I saw the gracious eyes with a something in them which I had never seen there before. They were snapping and flashing with indignation. I felt myself crumbling. I felt myself shrinking away to nothing under that accusing gaze. I stood silent under that desolating fire for as much as a minute, I should say. It seemed a very, very long time. Then my wife's lips parted, and from them issued my latest bathroom remark. The language perfect, but the expression velvety, unpractical, apprentice-like, ignorant, inexperienced, comically inadequate, absurdly weak and unsuited to the great language. In my lifetime I'd never heard anything so out of tune, so inharmonious, so incongruous, so ill-suited to each other as were those mighty words set to that feeble music. I tried to keep from laughing, for I was a guilty person in deep need of charity and mercy. I tried to keep from bursting, and I succeeded, until she gravely said, "There, now you know how it sounds." Then I exploded. The air was filled with my fragments, and you could hear them whiz. I said, "Oh, Livy, if it sounds like that, God forgive me, I will never do it again." Then she had to laugh herself. Both of us broke into convulsions and went on laughing until we were physically exhausted and spiritually reconciled. The children were present at breakfast, Clara, aged 6, and Susie, 8, and the mother made a guarded remark about strong language. Guarded because she did not wish the children to suspect anything, a guarded remark which censured strong language. Both children broke out in one voice with this comment, "Why, Mama, Papa uses it!" I was astonished. I'd supposed that that secret was safe in my own breast, and that its presence had never been suspected. I asked, "How did you know, you little rascals?" "Oh," they said, "we often listen over the balusters when you are in the hall explaining things to George." From Susie's biography. One of Papa's latest books is The Prince and the Pauper, and it is unquestionably the best book he has ever written. Some people want him to keep to his old style. Some gentleman wrote him, "I enjoyed Huckleberry Finn immensely, and am glad to see that you have returned to your old style." That annoyed me. That annoyed me greatly, because it troubles me. Susie was troubled by that word, troubles, T-R-O-B-L-E-S. And uncertain, she wrote a U above it in the proper place, but reconsidered the matter and struck it out. To have so few people know Papa, I mean really know him, they think of Mark Twain as a humorist joking at everything. And with a mop of reddish-brown hair which sorely needs the barber's brush, a Roman nose, short stubby mustache, a sad, careworn face, with many crow's feet, etc. That is the way people picture Papa. I have wanted Papa to write a book that would reveal something of his kind, sympathetic nature, and The Prince and the Pauper partly does it. The book is full of lovely, charming ideas, and oh, the language! It is perfect. I think that one of the most touching scenes in it is where the pauper is riding on horseback with his nobles in the recognition procession, and he sees his mother, oh, and then what followed, how she runs to his side, when she sees him throw up his hand, palm outward, and is rudely pushed off by one of the king's officers, and then how the little pauper's conscience troubles him when he remembers the shameful words that were falling from his lips when she was turned from his side, "I know you not, woman," and how his grandeurs were stricken valueless, and his pride consumed to ashes. It is a wonderfully beautiful and touching little scene, and Papa has described it so wonderfully. I never saw a man with so much variety of feeling as Papa has. Now the Prince and the Pauper is full of touching places, but there is most always a streak of humor in them somewhere. Now in the coronation, in the stirring coronation, just after the little king has got his crown back again, Papa brings that in about the seal, where the Pauper says he used the seal to crack nuts with. Oh, it is so funny and nice. Papa very seldom writes a passage without some humor in it somewhere, and I don't think he ever will. The children always help their mother to edit my books in manuscript. She would sit on the porch at the farm and read aloud with her pencil in her hand. And the children would keep an alert and suspicious eye upon her right along, for the belief was well grounded in them that whenever she came across a particularly satisfactory passage, she would strike it out. Their suspicions were well founded. The passages which were so satisfactory to them always had an element of strength in them which sorely needed modification or expurgation, and was always sure to get it at their mother's hand. For my own entertainment, and to enjoy the protests of the children, I often abused my editor's innocent confidence. I often interlarded remarks of a studied and felicitously atrocious character, purposely to achieve the children's brief delight, and then see the remorseless pencil do its fatal work. I often joined my supplications to the children's for mercy, and strung the argument out and pretended to be in earnest. They were deceived, and so was their mother. It was 3-1, and most unfair, but it was very delightful, and I could not resist the temptation. Now and then we gained the victory, and there was much rejoicing. Then I privately struck the passage out myself. It had served its purpose. It had furnished 3 of us with good entertainment, and in being removed from the book by me, it was only suffering the fate originally intended for it. From Susie's biography. Papa was born in Missouri. His mother is Grandma Clemens, Jane Lambton Clemens, of Kentucky. Grandpa Clemens was of the FFVs of Virginia. Without doubt, it was I that gave Susie that impression. I cannot imagine why, because I was never in my life much impressed by grandeurs which proceed from the accident of birth. I did not get this indifference from my mother. She was always strongly interested in the ancestry of the house. She traced her own line back to the Lambtons of Durham, England, a family which had been occupying broad lands there since Saxon times. I am not sure, but I think that those Lambtons got along without titles of nobility for 800 or 900 years, then produced a great man 3/4 of a century ago and broke into the peerage. My mother knew all about the Clemenses of Virginia and loved to aggrandize them to me, but she has long been dead. There has been no one to keep those details fresh in my memory, and they have grown dim. There was a Jeremiah Clemens who was a United States senator, and in his day enjoyed the usual senatorial fame, a fame which perishes whether it spring from 4 years' service or 40. After Jeremiah Clemens's fame as a senator passed away, he was still remembered for many years on account of another service which he performed. He shot old John Brown's governor Wise in the hind leg in a duel. However, I am not very clear about this. It may be that Governor Wise shot him in the hind leg. However, I don't think it is important. I think that the only thing that is really important is that one of them got shot in the hind leg. It would have been better and nobler and more historical and satisfactory if both of them had got shot in the hind leg. But it is of no use for me to try to recollect history. I never had a historical mind. Let it go. Whichever way it happened, I am glad of it, and that is as much enthusiasm as I can get up for a person bearing my name. But I am forgetting the first Clemens, the one that stands furthest back toward the really original first Clemens, which was Adam.